Topic of play. I would like to use the NICE group in C.S. Lewis's That Hideous Strength as a kind of counterfoil and try to present a picture that, in a sense, is the polar opposite of that. I remind you again of that marvelous quote of R. Maurice Boyd's in his book Running to Paradise when he says, "Dust we may be, with the dust of a star and troubled by dreams." Dust we may be, but the dust of a star and troubled by dreams. And we're confronted with the question as to whether survival is all that motivates us. Is that the final goal, the most basic goal of what it means to be a human being? Particularly if we as individuals, as a nation, as a race, as humankind, all eventually perish, ultimately with the perishing of the planet itself and the solar system, we're left with the question, what does it all mean? What are we living for? What does life mean to us? We're strange creatures. We raise ultimate metaphysical and religious questions, but in our physical existence, as Niebuhr reminds us, we are just as bound to the earth as are all other animals and plants, as are all living things. We dream of God. We've even given birth to Bach cantatas and Rembrandt drawings. We write great novels and we fly to the moon, but we also get sick, we throw up, we hurt one another, we blow our noses. This came home to me with great clarity a couple of years ago. It's possible that I used this illustration before. My wife was in the hospital. The doctors thought she was dying. And I had to talk with someone at church that evening about something. I talked with one of the elders about a couple problems. And he finally asked me if we had any prayer requests. And I turned to Carol and I said, "Carol, do you have any prayer requests?" She could barely talk. And she looked up at me and she said, "Yes, have the elders pray that when I need to blow my nose, I can find it." She couldn't find her nose because her coordination was so bad from the MS, and it took all her energy just to say that. And then there was that split second when you didn't know whether to laugh or cry. And fortunately, I started laughing, and she started laughing, and when I told Rich Jacobson over the phone what had happened, he started laughing, and we had that wonderful moment of relief in the midst of a very heavy situation, and all could laugh at that kind of strange, pathetic, wonderful contradiction of what it means to be a human being. And I think that somehow situates us in our life situation. And one of the kinds of questions that we need to ask is, are we sometimes too serious about who we are and about what we're up to? If life is just a matter of the useful, the successful, the sacrificing of the present moment for the future, the strain and sweat of college, graduate school, the quest for promotion and tenure, the putting aside of sufficient funds for retirement, keeping our cholesterol levels safe, and then someday we go to the hospital and die, perhaps among total strangers, what's it all about? Isn't there anything in life that is good in itself that pulls us out of our petite bourgeois way of living, our cost accountant mentalities, that something that might perhaps even make us willing to die for something? And it's in that context that I'd like to suggest the relevance of a very interesting theme that is found in the Jewish scriptures and also in some other religious traditions, but not as clearly, the theme that God was playing, not working, but playing when he created the world. But first let me share a brief quote from Heraclitus, that's H-E-R-A-C-L-I-T-U-S, one of the earliest Greek philosophers. Heraclitus said that the course of the world is a child at play, moving figures on a board back and forth. It is the kingdom of a child. And the text in Proverbs 8, verses 27 through 31 from the Jewish scriptures, suggests in the original Hebrew that in the creation of the world, the personified wisdom of God, Chokhmah in Hebrew, Sophia in Greek, the personified wisdom of God was playing or dancing like a little child when she assisted in the creation of the world. The text reads this, and this is a translation that I did with the help of one of my colleagues. The text says, "When he, that is God, established the heavens, I was there. When he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him like a little child. I was daily his delight, dancing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and delighting in the sons of men." I'll come back to the text presently, but first want to mention a quote from St. Augustine roughly 1,000 years after the Proverbs text. Augustine said that it is of the heart of sin that men use what they ought to enjoy and enjoy what they ought to use. It is of the heart of sin that we use what we ought to enjoy and enjoy what we ought to use. What did he mean by this? I think he meant something like this. Take something like money, one of the most creative and useful of cultural inventions. Think how awkward it would be when you travel, for instance, if you had to take with you a crate of chickens or a couple hogs or several bushels of wheat or corn to barter for your food and lodging and travel. No, we don't barter. We take money, or today we take that refinement of money, credit, and money is an extremely useful cultural invention. It facilitates living. It makes it much easier to get on with life. But notice what happens if you forget that money is to be used and begin to enjoy or value it for its own sake. You know what happens. You become a miser, and you quickly become enslaved by the very thing that ought to liberate you. Money becomes your god. You are enslaved by money if you value it for its own sake. Now, on the other hand, people are basically meant to be enjoyed, not used. We are to delight in each other, to treat each other not as means but as ends, to see each other as centers of dignity and value, and to refrain from exploiting and using each other and treating each other just as resources. People are to be enjoyed, not used. And if you take something like wine, for instance, the psalmist says that God gave us wine to gladden our hearts. We use wine to celebrate special occasions. But notice what happens if you forget that wine is to be enjoyed and begin to use wine or strong drink. Use it to drown out your troubles or to forget that you're not getting on so well with your spouse or your children or your employer. You know what happens. You again quickly are enslaved by the very thing that ought to bring happiness and joy to you. Wine is to be enjoyed, not used. So there's a dialectic of use and enjoyment. Some things like money to be used, other things like people and wine to be enjoyed and not to be used. Some things, such as some of the natural entities around us, like forest and land and so on, perhaps to be both used and enjoyed. Indeed, Reinhold Niebuhr maintains that biblical religion preserves a fine balance between use and enjoyment, between work and play, between doing and being. Michal showed us some of this in the Jewish scriptures a week ago when she showed us, helped us to see that the land and the animals and so on are both to be used and to be enjoyed. Reinhold Niebuhr captures some of this dialectic when he argues that human existence is a kind of timeline moving from the left to the right towards the ultimate realization of the kingdom of God. Secular philosophies have other symbols. The Marxists, for instance, saw the ultimate reality as the classless society. Let me actually, this is a little confusing to have God here too. Let's just refer to the kingdom of God. But Niebuhr argues that God in the biblical tradition, in Judaism and Christianity, and I think also in Islam, although I do not know this as well, that God is not just to be found at the end of history. God is not just to be found at the time when there is universal peace, when people get along with each other and are healthy and treat the natural world better than at present. God, says Niebuhr, is also to be found in each discrete moment of time. This is one of the insights that many of the mystics have had in Christianity and in other traditions. God is present everywhere at every time. Presbyterians speak of the presence of the Holy Spirit. Quakers speak of the presence of the Spirit or of the risen Christ. And one of the insights of biblical religion is that it is not just as you are successful and achieve the goals of society that you find the meaning of your life, but that the ultimate meaning of life intersects each discrete moment of time. So that there's a certain sense in which one might say, why are you so unhappy? Why are you so rushed and hurried? Why are you so compulsive about needing to control yourself and others and the world around you? Why not just stop for a moment, open your eyes, and there it is? Because, says Niebuhr in the biblical tradition, God is present in each discrete moment, so that the very meaning of your life is not found just when you are successful, but it is found, or at least is available, in each moment of your existence. Now, it is my conviction that in the modern Western world, we have lost much of the balance of the biblical worldview. Modern Western man, writes Harvard theologian Harvey Cox in his book, The Feast of Fools, feels too deeply the burden of leading a historically significant life. We feel too deeply the burden of living a historically significant life. Our sense of goal orientation is too highly developed. As I thought about this theme, I found it useful to place side by side two different sets of values. On the left side, values such as play, recreation, leisure, enjoyment, delight, sensitivity, celebration, worship, and awareness. And on the right side, values like work, achievement, success, and so on. And it seems to me that these correspond rather well to the two aspects of reality that Niebuhr is talking about. The one on the right, more utilitarian. It's good to be successful if your goals are good. On the left, those values that have to do with things that have meaning and value in themselves. And I would suggest that, on the whole, Western culture has been unduly fixated, has had a kind of compulsive fixation on the values on the left-hand side of the chart. Even our times of recreation, it seems to me, seem somewhat compulsive. I may have used this illustration before, but take a phrase like, we take a vacation. And the reality, of course, is that we don't take vacations. Vacations take us. There's no way that you really can force a time of vacation to give you what you really want. You can only put yourself in that position and hope that something happens. Because leisure at the deepest level is not something you control and manipulate. That's just a continuation of work and domination and control. Leisure is something that takes you. The other phrase I may have commented on already is the phrase, we take a nap. But of course, we don't take naps. Naps take us. And if you try too hard to take a nap, you won't ever fall asleep. You know the problem. But it's when you let go, when you cease trying to control, that the nap may end up taking you. Herbert Butterfield, in his interesting book, Christianity and History, was commenting on the way the Nazis and the Marxists were willing to use people, to treat them as means rather than ends, to run roughshod over the lives, the dignity of millions of human beings. And he makes this comment. He says, it has been said that if a lamb should die in May, before it had reproduced itself, or contributed to the development of the species, or provided a fleece for the market, still the fact that it frisked and frolicked in the spring was in one sense an end in itself, and in another sense, something that tended to the glory of God. Let me repeat that. It's a marvelous quote. If a lamb should die in May, before it had reproduced itself or contributed to the development of the species or provided a fleece for the market, all very useful. Still, the fact that it frisked and frolicked in the spring was in one sense an end in itself and in another sense something that tended to the glory of God. The great Westminster Confession of Faith of the Reformed Presbyterian tradition asks, what is the chief end of man? Answer, the chief end of man is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. To glorify God through seeking justice, through seeking peace, through seeking to alleviate hunger and poverty. But notice it doesn't end there. It ends, and to enjoy Him forever. The Roman Catholic novelist and literary critic Romano Guardini, G-U-A-R-D-I-N-I, Romano Guardini, has argued that the liturgy of the Catholic Church, if we analyze it according to its form rather than its content, is far sooner a kind of play than it is work. Far sooner a kind of play than it is work. He says the liturgy of the Catholic Church is full of meaning, but it has no purpose. You don't worship God in order to achieve something else, because that would be a contradiction. You don't worship God ideally in order to impress your parents or your spouse or your employer, or in order to become a good person, or in order to feel better. Because if you're doing that, then you are simply using God to achieve some higher goal, which means that that higher goal is really your God. And that's a contradiction, because God, by definition, is that highest being or reality. Worship is full of meaning, but it has no purpose. You don't do it for the sake of something else, says Guardini. Listen to what he writes. He says the liturgy speaks measuredly and melodiously, employs formal, rhythmic gestures, is clothed in colors and garments foreign to everyday life. It is in the highest sense the life of a child, in which everything is picture, melody, and song. It is a pouring forth of the sacred, God-given life of the soul. It is a kind of holy play in which the soul, with utter abandon, learns how to waste time for the sake of God. How un-American. Wasting time for the sake of God. What does he really mean there? I think what we might ask ourselves is how many of us really know how even to waste time for each other's sake? To be with a spouse, a child, a roommate, a lover, with no external purpose in mind, but just because it is good to be with that person. To be out in the wilds on a beautiful day like this, not because you're trying to relax or study the flora and fauna, but just because it's good in itself. Ideally, that's why we listen to Mozart or Bach. That's why we look at the Rembrandt drawings or the Picasso paintings, because these are experiences that are not essentially for the sake of something else. They're good in themselves. Here was the absolute corruption of art and architecture in the Soviet Union, because the ideology said that everything has to be useful, full of use. And when art has to be useful, it loses its very soul. That's not to say that any of these experiences do not benefit us in many ways, but if you enter into them in order to gain something, you destroy them. Worship is learning how to waste time for the sake of God. This is one reason, incidentally, why in the realm of play, we have always realized that you have to limit the playing field. If this is a soccer or a football field, you have limits on the field, because according to play theory, you have to psychologically cut yourself off from the outside world out here. You can't get the ball, for instance, in football and start running for Syracuse, even though you might do it very well and very quickly. You have a playing field. And one of the things that Professor Moss here at Cornell has illustrated so nicely, he says if you have a Little League baseball field with the bases here, and then over on the side the anxious parents looking on, what far too often happens is that the real psychological dynamics of the play are between the anxious child and the anxious parent. That is, they violate the sacred space of the playing field. For something truly to be play, it has to be done for its own sake. And if you violate the sacred space of the playing field, it's no longer play, it's work. You can exert enormous energy in play, but you do it for its own sake. This is why in churches there's always a sense of the sacred space. What goes on in the church, although it has relevance to the outside world, one would hope, in terms of social justice and better lives, what goes on inside of the church is, in a sense, psychologically separate. What I'm suggesting here is that human beings in our modern Western world desperately need zones of safety. We need places, times, where we can be liberated from the need to be useful, successful, from the need to justify or prove ourselves. And I think this is also true in our relation to nature. Nature is not just a resource. It is not just to be used. It is also to be valued for its own sake, to be enjoyed. I've commented earlier in a previous lecture on the way in which the university has corrupted our quest for knowledge, that to a very large degree we have seen knowledge simply as useful and as giving us control and power. We have too rigorously developed our analytical objective orientation so that it is always we who call the shots and nature who obeys. We manipulate. Nature is subservient. You might recall the terminology I used in an earlier lecture regarding the language we use to describe knowledge. We attack problems. We have keen minds, sharp ideas. We pursue knowledge. We talk about a volley of questions, incisive arguments, crushing objections, devastating criticisms, the cutting edge of a discipline, hard facts, and we go on. And as I pointed out in an earlier lecture, the truth is that there are many kinds of knowledge that are very, very different. Knowledge that is subtle and changeable and intuitive, the knowledge that a mother has nursing an infant, the knowledge that you gain sitting by an Adirondack lake in early September, quietly watching the mist rise off the water, the knowledge of lovers, the knowledge of close friends, very, very different from what has come to dominate the university. What I'm suggesting is not that hard facts and objective knowledge is unimportant. Modern science is one of the great creations of the human spirit. Our lives would be impoverished in many ways without it. What I'm suggesting, as the entire course has suggested, is the need for a new balance. That human life at its best involves a balancing of use and enjoyment. And I think that balance in part comes as we take seriously some of the authors we read earlier in the course. Reinhold Niebuhr helps us, for instance, to understand why we are so compulsive about needing to be in control. He refers to our finitude, our limitations, our mortality that is coupled with our freedom and that thus leaves us insecure and anxious. Snow talks about death as diminishment. We fear the diminishment of our powers and our ultimate demise. We fear death. Hebrews 2:15, in disturbingly accurate language, speaks of human beings as those who, quote, through fear of death were subject to lifelong bondage. Our compulsive acquisition of power and of things, our compulsive manipulation of nature, I would suggest, is very closely related to the fact that as a society we suppress our understanding of death or confront it in rather bizarre ways that make us, in a sense, numb to the reality of death and permit us to isolate ourselves from it. Dr. Armand Nicolai, a professor at Harvard, writing in the American Journal of Psychiatry some years ago, said that he found a significant number of motorcycle enthusiasts, this was roughly 20 years ago, whom he had as patients. He said that they appeared to be using their cycles to compensate for deep feelings of inadequacy and impotence. Driving is a very physical feeling. This, incidentally, has to be taken in context. There are other people I know very well who like to drive motorcycles just because it's fun and pleasurable in itself. But he quotes one student, driving is a very physical feeling. My new machine has a big motor. Without this under me, I feel I can do any, or with this under me, I feel I can do anything I want to. Another student comments, if I got rid of the bike, there would be nothing but me. And that's not enough. Which raises the very, very interesting questions of why we want power and why we want material possessions. I would suggest that at a very deep level, Americans are not at all materialistic in the literal sense of the term. If we truly cared for and loved things, I think we would treat them very differently than we do. If we truly loved and respected nature, we would be far less compulsive about our need to dominate it. I would suggest that at some fundamental level, we're not materialists. We are simply using things to compensate for our own insecurity. And that we really don't love things in the proper sense. We simply use them in a narrow, compulsive, unfree sense. Now, where does this leave us? How do we become free? How do we go beyond our fear of death and our compulsive need to be in control? Where is liberation to be found? These are serious questions, and to a large extent, the entire course has been an attempt to answer these questions. Robert Frost, one of the preeminent poets of America, many years ago said this. He said, "A poem begins in delight and ends in wisdom. A poem begins in delight and ends in wisdom." I can, to this day, distinctly remember, maybe 20 years ago or so, reading that for the first time, and being absolutely startled and delighted that here in this short sentence were all of the key terms from the text in Proverbs 8. Poem comes from the Greek poiein, which means to make or to do or create. The Proverbs text is about the creation of the world. Delight, in the Robert Frost quote, directly parallels the term delight or dancing or playing in the Proverbs text. If I had a little more time, I'd open up some of the terms in the texts. Shashuim in Hebrew has a meaning of delight or plaything, my friend said one of the images is the image of a parent bouncing a child on his knee, a time of just happiness and playfulness. Shechet in Hebrew, rejoicing, laughing, dancing, merrymaking. Delight, dancing, playing, found both in the Frost quote and in the Proverbs text. And the term wisdom in both texts, wisdom as the personification of God involved in the creation of the world. A poem begins in delight and ends in wisdom. The Dutch biologist Boutendijk says in a marvelous quote, perhaps I've used it before in the course, he says, "The birds are singing more than Darwin permits." The birds are singing more than Darwin permits. I think with reference to the theory that everything that animals do and everything that human beings do ultimately has to be useful. Boutendijk is not convinced. He thinks that animals as well as human beings play just out of the sheer joy of living. Karl Barth, the late Swiss theologian, one of the great creative theologians of the 20th century, shares an insight in one of his writings that I find enormously provocative and intellectually stimulating. He says that although in the Jewish Scriptures, the Sabbath is the last day of God's creative activity, it was the first full day of human existence. It was the last day of the week of creation, but it was the first full day of human existence. Now, Barth goes on then and says, what does this mean? What theological significance can we get from this? And in a wonderful kind of midrash on the text, he says what the writer maybe is trying to say, and I won't argue whether the writer actually was saying this or not. Part of the creativity of interpretation in a given tradition is you take the text, as the Jewish rabbis have done for centuries, and try to make sense out of it in terms of the world in which you live today. But Bart says one of the things that this suggests is that God so fashions the world that human beings don't start by needing to justify and prove themselves. You don't start off by having to prove that you're a good person, that you're successful, that you know how to work, that you know how to deserve the good things in life. But human existence, according to Jewish tradition, says Bart, and he accepts this also as a Christian, he's writing as a Christian, he says human existence starts with the Sabbath. It starts with a gift. It starts with play, with leisure, with recreation. It starts with a time of celebration. And what he basically says is that it is out of this time of leisure that one is able to get a deeper sense of the richness, the goodness, the wonder of life. And this essentially liberates one, also among other things, to work. That work is not then the compulsive attempt to justify our own existence because we're unsure of who we are and need to prove our value. Work is the kind of joyful response of the person who already has discovered the richness of her existence and the goodness of life, and now also joyfully is able to go about the tasks of life that are necessary for survival. The Sabbath is not the reward for hard work. It is a kind of launching pad into life. It is a time when you simply stop all work, stop all attempts to justify yourself, to prove your worth, and simply open your eyes and realize how fundamentally good life really is, or in the more specifically religious context, you discover something of the love of God. Some 2,000 years ago, Jesus said, "He that saveth his life will lose it, and he that loses his life will find it." St. Paul, in his own brand of religious language, speaks of being crucified with Christ. The old self must die so that the power of Christ can become effective in a person's life. Iris Murdoch, writing in a more secular context, speaks about unselfing. She says we have to let go of our preoccupation with ourself, very similar to Niebuhr's comments that we have to be willing to see the old self shattered at the very center of its existence. Jews traditionally spoke about the need to stop worshiping idols, those false gods that promise you life, but which are unable to deliver on their promises: money, security, sex, wealth, power, reputation, and so on. All of these, I think, in different ways, are attempts to answer the fundamental question, how can I be free? How can I find, in the midst of a very busy existence, zones of safety and freedom and leisure? Can I find a way, psychologically, spiritually, to separate the sacred spaces of worship and celebration and leisure and play from the more utilitarian workaday world? Those are the questions, because my thesis in this course is that it is not until we learn that we don't have to prove ourselves through our achievements, through our possessions, through our domination and control of one another. We don't have to use sex and money and power to control other people or to bolster our own sagging egos. That we can rather start with the realization that life is very different from that, that you can start with Sabbath, you can start with play, and out of the context of the Sabbath and of play, you can move on to a kind of liberation. Jesus said, unless you become as little children, you will in no wise enter into the kingdom of God. How interesting that Heraclitus, as a Greek philosopher, some 2,500 years ago, Jesus, the author of Proverbs 8, there's a kind of consensus of sorts that there is something in us that needs to become like little children if we're going to find who we really are. Permit me just a bit of foolishness. Let me close by playing a little game with you to illustrate what I'm trying to say. I'm going to need the mics, Jim, Carl. This is a magic box. It looks like a book by Jürgen Moltmann called Theology of Play, but it's really a magic box. And there's $1 million in this box, and I would like to give this to one of you. No strings attached. I'd just like to give this to one of you. Now, who would like this magic box with $1 million? There's a hand right up behind you here. Give him the mic, Carl. Okay, here's a magic box. Let's see, your first name?
Jeremy.
Jeremy, this is a magic box with $1 million in it, and I want to give it to you now. Do you want to take it?
Sure.
Okay, there's just one little hitch here. We've got to use our imagination further. Jeremy doesn't have much money, and he just had about $3-4 left, and he had spent that last money he had. He had, a $5 bill, and you spent $3.50 on a Big Mac and some French fries, and you're holding those in your right hand, and then in your left hand you don't have any pockets. Let's pretend you're holding the dollar bill and the change. And you're standing over a grate in the sidewalk, and if you take this box, which takes both hands, you're going to have to let go both of the money. You're going to lose it. And I see a dog over there a little ways away. He's eyeing your Big Mac. And if you let go of that, he's probably going to grab it. So you're going to lose your money and your Big Mac. And you don't have any more money. You going to risk it?
Yeah.
Okay. You risk it. You take the box. And you open it up. And sure enough, there's $1 million in it. Now, let's take this story just a little further, this game. Jeremy, you don't know this, but one of your colleagues, Audrey here, she looks like a respectable citizen, but she has a penchant for gambling. And when she left home a few weeks ago, her parents had given her, let's actually say the beginning of the semester. Her parents had given her about $12,000 for tuition and room and board. And she stopped on the way from L.A., she stopped in Las Vegas, and she blew the whole thing. She just blew it all. And let's imagine we're back now in late January, and I've talked to Audrey, and she's repented of her foolishness. She says she'll never do this kind of stupid thing again. She's going to reform, no more gambling. But she desperately needs $12,000 to finish her semester here. Could you give her that much? Go ahead.
Sure.
Well, why not? Okay. You give her 12, and there's Kurt up there. He looks like a respectable student, a student, but he loves to play the stock market. I mean, you don't know this about him, but he actually was coming from Boston, but he stopped in New York on the way to Ithaca, and he invested. He had about $12,000 too for the last semester, and he lost $8,000 of it playing stocks. He stopped on Wall Street, and he only had $4,000 left. He needs $8,000 to finish up the semester. Could you give him 8 too?
Yeah.
Okay. You got the 8 and you got the 12. And now let's see. You had 1 million. How much does he have left in his magic box? How much? 980,000. Does that sound right? You think that's right? You're all wrong. You forgot. This is a magic box. Now, if you open up this box, Jeremy, there's not going to be 980,000 in it. In fact, if you open it up and look, there's going to be about 1,100,000 in it. Because this box is magic. And the more you give away, the more you have in it. Very strange, interesting magic box. Now, what am I trying to say with this foolishness? What I'm trying to suggest is that one of the basic themes of this course is that life at a very deep level is like the magic box. And the more you give away, the more you stop trying to justify yourself, to prove your own worth, to get more power and things to prove that you're better than someone else, the more you stop worshiping the idols of sex, money, power, reputation, and so on, the richer you will be. And the more likely we will be not only to treat one another generously, but the more likely we will be to treat the plants and animals, the rivers and forests and mountains more graciously. That the person who is wealthy existentially is the person who is free to live graciously. When we feel ourselves, when we believe ourselves to be poor, it is very hard to be generous, to give other human beings and animals and nature space to exist and to flourish. Life is like the magic box. And it's interesting, as I was reflecting on this last night, the magic box illustration has another kind of odd twist that I'd never thought of before. I was thinking about Iris Murdoch. Because in one sense, if we take Iris Murdoch seriously, the self in itself is not much more interesting than the remains of the Big Mac and the dollar and 50 cents. She says the self in itself, if it becomes the center of our lives, is not going to be very interesting. It is as you are captivated. She now writing in a secular context, not a religious context. As you are captivated by great art and music and by the sheer, delightful, wonderful reality of the world about you, the plants and animals and other human beings, it's as you are unselfed that you will discover how exciting life really is. And it dawned on me, Jeremy, the first time last night that in a way the self in one sense is not a whole lot more interesting than the fragments of the Big Mac. That it is as we let go of the self that we discover this incredible mystery and wonder of life itself. That we discover the real self, the deeper self, or in religious terms, the reality of God. The self can become perhaps the most tenacious, the preeminent idol of all, and thus the most difficult to let go of. Okay, enough foolishness for today. That's all.